we will always ultimately come to the point where darkness sets in. Here we must either admit ignorance or try to bluff. Or we must deny our own ignorance and try to force an opinion or some form of a concept upon others concerning that which we do not know. Now, the light runs out in a number of directions. One of the directions in which one of our deepest problems lies is that the area of the unknown, for most persons, involves the inner lives of other people. We have the greatest amount of light on surfaces. We have a considerable amount of physical light on physical surfaces. We look out as we drive our car, we see the roads, we see the trees, we see the people. There doesn't seem to be any lack of light. But the moment we leave surfaces, either to ascend or descend from the obvious, we begin to come into a twilight region, and from that pass finally to utter darkness. When we try to understand other people, we realize that what we call understanding them is nothing more than bestowing our own attributes upon these other people. We interpret them only in terms of ourselves. They interpret us only in terms of their own natures. So as far as the facts are concerned, the inside, the inner part of everything is dark. Sometimes it's a little darker than at other times, but there is always a gray shadow there somewhere. The inside of ourselves is dark. We have no real ability to declare with absolute certainty the experience of our own inner life. We live upon a surface, and onto this surface seems to float upward a great deal of subjective material, but we do not know just where it comes from or how it reaches the surface. The depths of ourselves, the depths of other things are strangely dark. The difference between a light area and a dark area for man is also one other thing. In light areas, we have light because we have experienced. Perhaps not now, but sometime. Always where there is light, it means that whatever that light pertains to, we have done. We have actually achieved a distinct victory wherever light seems to cast itself upon other things. If we see a thing correctly, it is because we have truly experienced the fact of that thing. Darkness is always an area of non-experienced existence. It means that in that particular area, we can only depend upon the opinions of others, hearsay, belief, tradition, or at best, second-hand experience transmitted from others. The second-hand experience may cause a certain pre-dawn to break a little. We may see a little gray shadow where the darkness was before, and it looks as though a little light was there. But until we have actually experienced it ourselves, there can be no true light. For this light cannot be reflected from the consciousness of other people. Each person, in his search for light, must light the outside from the inside. There is no escape from this absolute necessity. To grow is then to be able to increase the areas of light. To grow is to gradually take the shadows away from dark areas. And as we take the shadows away, the facts of those areas, now lighted, become available for use. The more of these lighted areas exist, the more certainties we have. Let us take an anthropological point of view for a moment. Our remote ancestors had mostly darkness and very little light. They feared everything. They feared physical darkness. They feared a clump of trees a few hundred feet from the cave where they lived. They feared every animal, every creature. They feared the sky and the winds and the lightning and the thunder. And they bestowed upon practically every energy of nature the power to hurt them. These persons were therefore forced to exist in a vast world of fears. For wherever there is no light, there is much fear. Down through time, this very process of growing has gradually reduced these fear factors. We no longer regard the thunders as the voices of angry gods. We no longer think of lightning as something aimed at us because we have broken some taboo or have failed to make proper offerings on the altars of demons. We no longer regard everything around us as fearful. Little by little, we have come to understand some of the elements of our own existence. Wherever we have understood, light has come, and on this understanding we have built progress, and this progress is a collective form of growth. But where from the beginning to now, the dark areas have never been cleared. In these areas, we still have primordial fears. We still find that when we let down the surface courage arising from mutual support, we do experience some of the old atavistic terrors that burdened our forebears. Many people are still intensely superstitious. Many are still convinced of the presence of great evil forces moving behind the mistakes of mankind. We haven't yet learned that these evils are really a combination of darkness and our own inability to find the light of solution to problem. Thus, the whole situation at any moment in our lives is that we have certain availabilities and certain lack of availability. And if this was clear to us at every moment, it would be very wonderful. If we could see all the things we really think we know with little rings of light around them, and all the little things that we don't think we know with little rings of darkness around them, so the mind could say, this I know and this I do not know, it is obvious, it would be quite simple. By now we would have been out conquering practically every weakness of our own natures. If even a little bell rang when things were wrong, it would cause a great deal of happiness for all concerned and also an awful lot of bell ringing. But at the same time, it would be useful. But here is our difficulty. Wherever there is a hole in our insight, wherever knowledge ceases, wherever the light of our experience fails, the dark part is invisible. The dark part is not something that you can measure in the same way that you seem to be able to measure light. When you say an individual is rather brilliant, that he has a marvelous ability to meet situations, you're talking about the light side of him. But when you ask someone, what is it that this person does not know? That's very hard to answer. You have a suspicion, it's a long list, but you don't know where it begins or how. When you say to yourself, where do my own certainties end and my own uncertainties begin? This takes a great deal of thought, because the certainties and the notions and the opinions form such a surfacing that we are not aware of the vacant areas in our own insight. They simply do not testify at all, so we do not know they exist. The only way we find out they exist is when we make a very stupid blunder of some kind and wonder how we did it. How could we have missed this entire area of probabilities? It is only under such a condition as that that we suddenly become aware of these blind spots in our reason. Otherwise, it just looks as though the light is always there and always abundant, so we keep on living by the light part and allowing the dark part to pass unnoticed. But there's too much dark there. We cannot actually make an adequate adjustment. We cannot be in the presence of so much that we do not know and still at the same time make a good job of living. One way in which we can, of course, come to some conclusions about this subject, at least academically, is to try to list the things that we know, the things that we do not know. It would be quite obvious that the average man probably does not know how to bake a good cake. He has never tried. On the other hand, some of the greatest bakers that have ever lived have been men, so that the problem doesn't present any insurmountable obstacle. But a person will say with some frankness, I don't know how to do this. I've never done it. Now, this is fine as far as it goes, but do we carry this sense of honesty deeply enough? Do we look at a person and say, I do not know how to judge you? Usually we do not. Usually we depend on the light part of our understanding, ignore the dark part, and come to a prejudiced opinion. So this dark area is always a potential area of prejudice. It is always an area in which our opinions, our attitudes, our beliefs are not valuable. And most people cannot live with the idea that they have any ideas, attitudes, or beliefs that are not valuable. We assume that they are all right. And we try to force ourselves beyond the point where our abilities actually will sustain true progress. The answer always is not that you can overcome all this ignorance immediately. No one can. There are many things to be known in this world that man will not be able to know for a very long time. But there is a wonderful strength not only in knowing what you know, but also in knowing that you do not know. This brings with it a certain caution. This causes us to reconsider and to perhaps try a little harder to arrive at a better conclusion. If we are perfectly willing to withhold finality of judgment, perhaps the scripture was very wise when it pointed out that vengeance belongs to the Lord and that God will repay, because God alone, apparently, or the principle of universal consciousness which we associate with God, is at least theoretically the only consciousness that knows everything. Man does not. Man's knowledge is in the constant process of enlargement. And this enlargement is his growth. Growth must begin by the recognition of what we know, where we are in knowledge, and also the full recognition of that which we do not know. And because the fact that we do not know is the larger equation in most instances, we have to proceed rather cautiously. Knowledge must be extended from foundations established in consciousness. We cannot plunge into some vast abstraction far from the shores of certainty. What we must do in each case is extend the known carefully, methodically, thoughtfully to its next areas of probability. We must light near to where light already is. We cannot flash this light into the midst of the darkness and expect to have it very solutional. Growth, then, is a gradual encroachment upon darkness. It is a little more and more of light extending cautiously, carefully, wisely into the unknown. The person can constantly build upon what he already possesses. And as he continues to build, the structure of his consciousness enlarges. The structure of his insight enlarges. And gradually, knowledge leads to experience, which brings further light Light is always the experience factor. Light is the thing known certainly by having actually experienced that thing. To begin the cycle of growth, then, is to become aware that the so-called ego, or self, is itself in the process of becoming. It is not something that is complete. The ego cannot turn to us the current of universal knowledge. We cannot dig deeply enough into the ego to get any more out of it than is in there. This is a mistake people have had the tendency to make. They have assumed that because something is inside of us, this must be infallible. It is not. The judgments of the ego can never be greater than the experiences which are stored in the coordinator, or this force, factor, which brings all experience to bear upon new experience, or brings experience to bear upon the challenge for the need of experience. So there's no use hunting inside the personality for infallibles. They will not be found there. The best that is going to come out is the best that is in there. Now, there's much more in there than there used to be. That is why, in spite of our mistakes and in spite of our neglects, man is growing. He is growing because little by little the content of the experienced part of knowledge is constantly growing, but slowly, not nearly as rapidly as we wish it would grow. There is also another very tricky factor which you seldom hear discussed and which does not usually obtrude itself into this problem. Namely, that as man is learning by experience to adjust to certain situations, the processes of history are making these situations themselves extinct. The individual may have passed through a great deal of experience in the Roman Empire. Let's imagine the consciousness learned certain things in the Roman Empire, or in one of 100 previous embodiments. This would be much more helpful if we still had a Roman Empire. But unfortunately, we do not. So experience divides itself very clearly into two levels. Experience which is only useful in a condition which itself is highly time-bound. The experiences that we may have passed through during the Crusades or during the medieval period in history will not necessarily be sufficient to equip us for the problems of today. Just as the young man today graduating from school could not go back 10 years from now and take the same examination and pass. He could not do it. Not because he is not thoughtful, but because the whole system of instruction will have changed, and he will not be able to adapt himself to it without taking the entire course over again. Very few graduates could graduate a second time 5 years later. This means that there is an experience pattern that is extremely immediate. This is very largely the experience of particulars. The problem as to whether we should eat with our fingers or knives and forks is a very transitory problem. Also, the skill we may learn in driving an automobile may be of no use to us, except for the particular embodiment in which we now find ourselves. But behind and below this level of passing experience patterns, there is another which reminds us of the fact that essential elements do not change very rapidly. For example, the person learning to drive a car conscientiously, intelligently, honorably, and with due consideration for the rights of others may never drive a car again after he gets through with this life. But his due consideration and his conscientiousness and his thoughtfulness and his prudence will be useful forever. Thus, we cannot tie these achievements entirely to an incident or to a level. For true growth is always a growth of principles. And this is why so much of modern education is wasted. Because unless principles are given, the individual learns things which have no permanent utility. The person who learns to keep the police code may be a criminal himself 2 years from now because the code will change. But the individual who recognizes the basic rights of man around which all codes are built will be honorable under the Roman Empire or under any other system that ever comes into existence. If his own integrity is right, he is growing. And in this process of growing, he is building a character which will serve him better wherever he is as a person. The real reason behind growth is always the maturing of the power of the individual to keep the rules of existence. Now, among the most shadowy areas of our personality are those areas. There is that general area which has to do with principles. We have great difficulty in understanding the more abstract phases of universal law. Certain laws we can see and work with. We recognize the law of gravity. We recognize that water has a tendency to flow downhill, and things of this nature. But when it comes to the moral laws of life, we're not sure of them at all. And when it comes to the great question of what the universe expects and demands of us, there is really very little uniformity of opinion. These great areas of principles, what is truth, what is beauty, what is love, these great thoughts generally catch us in dark areas. We do not know how to cope with them. When we think of love, we can only think of human affection. It is very difficult for us to conceive of a universal affection. When we think of beauty, we think of it in terms of what we like now. We have no real understanding of its deeper significance. We are subject, therefore, to shifting standards in all these things. When we ask ourselves, what does the universe want me to do next? We are in an area where there is not too much light generally available. A little, perhaps, a little more than we admit sometimes. Because we're not always very anxious to do what the universe wants to be done next. It may interfere with what we want to do next. But if it does interfere, and we permit our own purposes to overshadow universal purposes, we're not going to grow directly. We're going to grow the hard way, through having broken faith with the rules of the game. But let's say for the moment that we really want to grow, and we want to do what is next. We want to do what is best for all concerned. We would like not to evade anything. We would like to head into that experience which will most enrich us and will most help us to grow. All philosophy agrees that to make this decision, the first requirement is that we become impersonal. We cannot serve God and Caesar successfully at the same time. Caesar, in this case, being ourselves. We cannot do exactly what we want to do and still be uniquely attentive to the universal plan of things. We're not that far advanced that our own desires will always conform with universal good. This is too much to ask. So the decision must be, that before we can decide what is good, we must be willing to accept the decision and do that which is indicated. We must be perfectly willing to put this good above our own personal feelings. This is a conflict. It is always a conflict. And is the reason why all over this world today there are people who have beautiful ideas but are not doing very well with them, actually, in practice. But if we really want to grow, and grow as rapidly and effectively as possible, this strange sense of the impersonality of right must be experienced within us. We must say to ourselves truly that the universal will must be done. What is it that the deepest part of my insight concerning existence tells me is the next thing to do? The final end of experience is in itself that it always does point the way to the next thing. But it does not point the way to things 10 or 15 steps removed. Experience almost always tells us why we are right or why we are wrong. But we are not too attentive. So we can say that if the person will place that which is right and that which is necessary and that which is good above his own personal desires, he has a very good chance of being able to estimate the next thing for himself. In a broad, general manner, one thing we can nearly always point out as a formula, not always, but it is an overwhelmingly common formula, and that is, if it's hard and you don't like it, it's next. Now, this is practically scripture. If it is the thing you say, Lord, deliver me from, that is probably what you should be working on. If it is next to impossible, it is next. Most folks would rather do the things which are easy. This means they would rather repeat previous experience. If they've gotten so good at it for the last 50,000 years that it just practically is automatic, then they're willing to make a supreme effort and do exactly what they intended to. But if it's difficult, If it means that the person has to make some unique and rather unpleasant effort, in the general thought that all effort is unpleasant, if the person finds that it is not the thing that a lazy man can do, if it is not a continuance of the existing pattern, then probably it is high time to do something about it. Another good rule is, if something is hurting you, your next problem is to find out why. This process of going on, being hurt forever, and simply suffering is not nature's plan. If you are sitting on a hot stove, do not assume for a moment that the infinite requires you to stay there. But it may take a certain amount of energy to jump off the stove. But certainly at that moment, that jump is next. In each instance, the immediate problem is nearly always the challenge. The immediate problem is the thing that must be now faced. And we must gather up all our resources to face it. For the moment we face it, it ceases to be a problem. A problem solved ceases. A problem unsolved comes back and nags us through ages, if necessary. No problem unsolved will ever really disappear. No problem unsolved can be completely left behind. We may push it to one side. We may put it off for the moment. But if it's there, it will come home to us in the end. This process of pushing it off and having it hit back, the process of tossing it to one side and having it bounce back and hit us again, means that the longer we procrastinate a solution, the more we will suffer from the problem. So the growth is the sense or the concept of moving into the problem now. To move into it, not with regret, not with pious sense of martyrdom, not with a deep, soul-shaking sigh. The problem is to move in on it, solve it, and watch it dissolve. Once we move in upon the problem, experience the problem, experience the power to solve that problem, we have achieved a step of growth. Now, the problems that beset most of us most intimately are of three general kinds. The first is dispositional. We all have faults. We all have plenty of them. But all our faults do not come into focus at any one time. This is lucky. But there is nearly always one fault in focus at almost any time. We discover that in some one way, we are at this moment our own worst enemy. This is the one we have to work on now. When that is gone, do not be lonely. There'll be another. Come along. But it will be different, and there is a certain delight in variety. But this problem will not go until it is faced. Nearly everyone knows that they have character problems. They can even name them. But if you look into your environment, your business, your home, your social life, your relationship with yourself, your ability to live with other people or work with other people, you will find that there is one besetting situation at this moment that could be improved. That things are not as smooth as they could be, and the reason is somewhere in you. You can say you're tired. You can say you're nervous. You're saying you don't know any better. You're saying that other people just simply prod you along until you can't stand it any longer. But the problem is there, and the problem must be solved. The only way that it can cease to be a problem is to be outgrown. The second type of problem, which nearly everyone faces in the course of their daily life, is adjustment to situations around them. Here we have the individual in the presence of something that he feels he cannot change. Other people will not do what he wants or what he expects them to do or what he believes they should do. But they have the monotonous habit of being there anyway, making things more complicated for this individual. The answer here is now a matter of adjustment relationship. If the situation is essentially bad, then it may require courage to break the situation. To admit that it is wrong, and to admit that we're staying in it because of some weakness or some instinct to compromise or dishonesty or some selfishness or some status symbolism. And we are not willing to admit the fact that the pattern itself is bad. Perhaps nature's next lesson in experience is the individual giving up what he wants in order to attain peace of mind without which he cannot survive. This is a decision. If he decides wrongly, nature continues to penalize him. He has to finally decide whether he is going to sacrifice the lesser for the greater or vice versa. So here is an immediate area of problem in the life and condition of the person in his relationships with other people. The third area in which a problem perhaps presents itself lies in the matter of gaining new skills. There is nothing an individual dislikes more than the thought of going back to school after he's graduated. But many persons want to achieve good things, have serious and sincere desire to attain, have the instinct to be able to use what is attained, but they are still impotent as far as their ability to do these things is concerned. So we have the individual who has high motives and no training. We have the person who would gladly give his life, but at the present condition, his life isn't worth much. He has very little to give, which is a terribly frustrating thing and a very painful thing. A few break through this by tremendous resolution, but the majority are completely defeated by it. The moment we realize that what we know is not enough to meet the demands of our own ideals, our own principles, and our own convictions, then we have to learn more, regardless of what it costs. We have to give up pleasures to achieve these necessities, which become the basis of more enduring pleasures in the future. So where every person is well-intentioned but helpless, he must in some way correct this by gaining the abilities to do the things that he wants to do and which he realizes need to be done. So wherever we can't solve a problem because we simply do not know enough, then in one way or another we must seek to know more. Now the search to know more is a fascinating adventure in itself. But the desire for knowledge, apart from the proper use of knowledge, is itself a blind alley. The individual does not grow from what he knows alone. He grows from what he does with what he knows. For it is always the action that provides the experience, which provides the light, which is growth. So wherever we have any of these barriers between ourselves and advancement, we must either relinquish the idea of advancement or else we must overcome the barriers. Nature presses us to overcome barriers. It does this by constantly confronting us with small, nagging situations which we cannot quite handle, but sometimes feel that we ought to be able to. If we reject these small, nagging invitations long enough, they heap up into large matters, and we suddenly come headlong into a great monument of neglect or evasion, which seems pretty formidable, and which can hurt us very desperately when we try to break through this kind of a barrier. So always try to get rid of the small things one at a time as they come up. Because if you can do this, they will not make the large things. And each small thing conquered and experienced becomes a new light upon other things. It's very interesting that every drop of experienced consciousness that we have enriches the whole of our total egoic insight. As we get further and further into the true mysteries of light, as we recognize them in the ego itself, we come finally to realize that the end of growth is a mysterious condition of universal light. Now, the moment light is universal, the moment light is not separated by objects. For example, we can imagine that you stand a vase or a cup or a bowl on a table and you light it as you would if you were an artist going to draw a picture of this. The bowl stands out because of contrast. One area is lighted and the other area is not lighted. This results in modeling. It gives the picture its highlights and its shadows, and because of highlights and shadows, the picture exists. If there was nothing but high light, there would be nothing on the paper, whatever, except light. Thus, if we go on experiencing an increasing light and continually contribute to the decrease of shadow, we pass finally into the condition of consciousness in which there is no shadow. And this means, actually, that we have outgrown the entire concept of good and evil, of light and darkness. And the entity or the egoic nature itself becomes simply the center of a universal experience, so far as this experience is possible to us here. Nothing remains as a detail. Nothing can challenge, because the experience has absorbed all of that which is not known. In the experience of totality, the individual completes the possible experiences of egoic existence. This is more or less the concept of samadhi. It is also found in Zen. Because the total experience is strangely the end of experience. When there is nothing left to experience, the very factor of experience ceases. Because it can only live by conquering the unknown. When there is no longer any unknown, strangely enough, the value of both the known and the unknown cease. It's a very peculiar thing, but if you think it through carefully, you can get the idea in this sense. That man would never know that he was wise unless there were areas of ignorance in himself. He would never know that he is wiser than anyone else or less wise unless there were other people with whom he could compare himself. He can never tell how far along he is on the road if there are no road markers. And he can never tell how much truth he possesses unless he is able to contrast it to the absence of itself. If it should occur, therefore, that the individual achieves the total experience of the total use of all of his faculties and powers for the total purpose for which they were intended, you do not have a wise man, you do not have a good man, you do not have any of these qualifying terms that are meaningless without their opposites. You simply have a condition of universal adjustment. You have a thing that is completely identified with its own objects. It is subject-object in one. There is no longer any differentiation. When there is no difference between the thing experiencing and the thing experienced, you then have yoga, which is total union. In this total union, you then have the Buddhistic concept of the gradual extinction of the ego. The ego ceases, or the personality ceases, only when there is no longer any difference between our center of knowledge and the area of the knowable. When these are identical, the individual is in a state of total existence. This means that in terms of growth, that the cycle of growing as we know it has been completed. Thus, there being nothing further to challenge the consciousness does not come forward to meet challenge. If there is no advancement of consciousness to meet challenge, if man is not in the condition of rolling up his sleeves and swinging a club, if he is no longer in an unhappy relationship with anything, if he is no longer in a condition in which he has to fight in order to maintain his attitudes, because his attitudes have now become identical with fact and are no longer assailable, when all of these things, by means of which he has to know himself as something separate from other things and at war with them, when this ceases, when the individual is no longer called upon to adjust, whatever may be the inner nature of himself simply is no longer discernible. For we know ourselves only by what we do, and largely by our mistakes. What we do is only action in the terms of the conquest of the unknown in some form. We do one thing in order to survive. We do another thing in order to have housing. We do something else in order to be competitive with our neighbor. But when all of these values have been exhausted, then all of the pressures which normally come to the surface and by which we come to know ourselves as persons no longer come to the surface because they are no longer challenged. The individual then, in the terms of Buddhism, experiences the identification of himself with totality. He feels no need anymore to be a person because he realizes that a person is only a conditioned existence. And that the thing he's been trying to outgrow from the beginning was conditioned existence. And if he ever succeeds, if he finally attains his end, then the last thing he must outgrow is his own existence. So it would seem as though this is a nihilistic point, that by outgrowing his own existence, he simply ceases. But this is not actually true at all, because this adjustment to the pressure of situations or conditions is only a temporary relationship at best. The ego, as the experiencing thing, cannot be the true person. It cannot be the actual reality. Because if this actual reality has an existence, it has to have a total adjustment at all times. The personality, therefore, cannot be the true being. Nor can the personality discover the nature of the true being while it is conditioned by its own need for particular experience. So the end of the situation lies in the total elimination of the personality as a mask, a persona, an instrument. And that which is left, when the personality no longer rises to meet the challenge of experience and is therefore no longer to be distinguished, it cannot be invoked by circumstances, but remains or becomes absolutely quiescent, going to sleep because it is finished. In this particular moment, the entire pattern of existence has to shift from the negative to the positive. The creature which has existed only because it was wrong must finally give way to the creature that can only exist because it is right. And this is not the way we live. We are not the creature that can only exist because it is right. Therefore, this is another kind of creature. This is a kind of creature we cannot know because our own experience is not touched by it. But somewhere at the root of existence, at the root of our existence, beyond the individual always trying to get out of trouble, there must be the being that has never been in trouble. The creature that is moving positively rather than negatively. And Buddhism takes the attitude that when we come to the final extinction of this thing which we call the personality in the process of growth, what we are actually doing is moving from a negative to a positive side of our own complete being. In other words, we are the shadow. The shadow of light is our own personal being. The light is a reality. The darkness is the personality. Wherever light and shadow mingle, light stands for the reality that never changes, and darkness for the personality which in itself can never actually experience light. It can sense light. It can experience growth, but it cannot experience the true essence of truth. As we go along then, and there is more and more light and less darkness, there is more and more universality and less personality. And the time has to come when the individual simply changes its polarization. Whatever there is beyond this is a positive growth. a growth by means of true knowing, a growth in which the individual moves toward those ends which are real, instead of constantly moving away from those ends which are not real. So in the very core of this thing, there is this switchabout, in which after the personality, by evolution, has exhausted its ignorance, that which remains is the beginning of the reality, which then positively unfolds into light. As a plant growing must first dig its roots deep where they are not seen, it seems that the individual in unfolding has to first of all put its taproot deep into the illusion of darkness. And then only after it has subjectively built its dark rootage can it then gradually raise itself into the light and come forth. There is a point in man's evolution when there is this transference, when growth, as this long, difficult process toward attainment, achieves its end and dies in the process. The entire process of man as a person ceases in the fulfillment of itself. And in its place comes the experience of man as a total divine being. And this divine being is not ignorant, is not searching ways out of pain, but is established forever in insight by its own nature, and thus becomes not an involuntary creature growing, but a voluntary being unfolding according to true insight of purpose. Therefore, the negative personality growing up ceases when error ceases. But when error ceases, reality begins. And a being that we do not know, inhabiting a region we cannot fully comprehend, then takes over. And growth becomes merely the unfoldment of the true flower in the eternal light of truth. The bodhisattva state is represented by the lotus. And this lotus opens its petals to light, without resistance, without fear, without burden, without pain. And that which has finally outgrown its humanity comes to experience the dawn of its universal or divine existence. We do not have any words for this, but we do believe that growth finally ends in the end of the need for growth, and that therefore the conditioned existence of man ends in a conditionless state. And that which has striven so hard to climb from darkness into light finds that there is no need of itself after it has completed the climb. But there is something else, something deeper, something eternal in man, which is born in that moment when the struggle against ignorance ceases. So in that very moment when the person dies, phoenix-like, the divine being is born from its ashes. This is an alchemical transmutation. That which is truly eternal is triumphantly resurrected from all the temporal experiences of time. We cannot hope to understand this state in a conditioned existence, but we can sense within ourselves its reality. And toward the fuller experience of this transition, we hope by growth to attain the virtues necessary for the perfection of ourselves. Well, I think our time is up, so we'll have to let it go for this time, but we'll be with you again next week.